Hey, good morning to everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The final case on our calendar for oral argument today is State versus Stephen Bartold, A20-1053. Just a few preliminary remarks before we get started with your arguments. We are making a recording of this argument using the Zoom platform. We're on Zoom due to the COVID-19 pandemic, of course. The recording of your arguments will be available shortly on the court's website. In the meantime, I'll note that no other recordings of the argument are permitted. Our regular rules of decorum apply, and I would just ask when you are not actively making your argument to please make sure that you're on mute so we can eliminate background noise. Can you both see the timer that is displayed on the screen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, yes, Your Honor.
So that will count you down this morning. As you both know, the appellant has 15 minutes to present an oral argument. Respondent will likewise have 15 minutes, and then the appellant will have an opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. My final request of both of you is just to please introduce yourselves at the outset of your arguments. With that, we will now turn to counsel for the appellant. Mr. Kelly, you may proceed.
I'm going to do one thing.
And I'll just note, we've lost Mr. Kelly's video. And okay, so Mr. Kelly, are you able to hear us?
I am, Your Honor.
All right. So just one last thing that I'll say. If we happen to lose either of you during the argument, we will, of course, pause and wait for you to rejoin us before we continue with the argument. So, Mr. Kelly, are you now ready?
Yes.
You may go ahead.
May it please the court, I'm appearing representing the appellant, Stephen John Barthold. This primarily is a case concerning abuse of discretion of a continuance request by the court-appointed lawyer at the commencement of the probation violation hearing, which was occurred just prior to my client being sentenced to 276 months in prison for a drug offense. Abuse of discretion is something that no matter how much I try to find some type of definition, it really doesn't appear in a concrete bullet points, if you will. And so the only analogy that I could come up with was Justice Potter Stewart, who in defining protected speech obscenity laws states that, to coin a phrase, I just know it when I see it. Hard to define, but I know it when I see it. And it's hard to define abuse of discretion, but this case illustrates abuse of discretion. Now,
so Mr. Kelly, if I could just interrupt you right away, you've made several arguments regarding the denial of a continuance request. It appears that one is just an abuse of discretion in and of itself, but then you have brought this case via a post-conviction petition that was filed during a stay of the appeal. And I guess I'm wondering about the relationship between those two things. In other words, is it your position that regardless of the denial of an evidentiary hearing in the context of the post-conviction proceeding, we can just look at what happened at that probation revocation hearing and find an abuse of discretion based on the denial of the continuance request? Or do you need that evidentiary hearing to shore up your claim?
I would submit the former, Your Honor, and that is the abuse of discretion happened on a first appearance on Monday, June 8th, when the court-appointed lawyer appeared with my client in the midst of the COVID pandemic with an inability to converse with his client due to a lockdown at the jail, inability to attend, inability of the appellant to access phone other than a brief period of time each day, an investigator at the public defender's office that was on leave of absence due to a personal issue, and just an inability to be prepared. And you balance that, I would submit, a district court judge needs to balance that against the prejudice to the state. And there was no prejudice to the state. There was no possibility that a witness was going to disappear. It was, in terms of a lay witness, there was my client was going to be held in custody pending the next hearing. And that's why I think that I would submit that the TDF case that we cite, the Minnesota Supreme Court case, is so on point. It's on all fours. And my case is better than TDF's case because a lawyer in TDF indicated he was in trial in another town and unable to prepare over the short period of time for a certification hearing. And the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed on basically a lack of ability of counsel to prepare. But that was in the midst of a pandemic, and TDF wasn't in custody pending any continuance date. So my case is on all fours on the legal precedent, but even stronger argument in terms of that. So to answer the court question, I think that there was a number of abuses here, and I've done a little bit of a shotgun approach with my appellate brief, which I understand is frustrating to the reader at times. I thought that there was a lack of notice of with regard to the opportunity to meet the allegations. One of the things that's
well, let me just follow up. So, we have the transcript, of course, of the hearing where a continuance was requested and denied, and the public defender listed a few bases for requesting the continuance. Can we just look at those bases alone and determine that was sufficient sort of offer of proof and support of the continuance request?
And I would submit that TDF did the same thing. Yes. I think that is sufficient. Now, there's also sometimes ability of counsel to be prepared. Effective counsel can also be couched in terms of a due process argument. There's State v. Miller, which is cited in my brief, where lack of preparation of a public defender was argued as a violation of due process, a right to due process. It was unsuccessful, but that's how that was phrased. And the right to due process is something that this court reviews de novo. So I think that when you talk about the due process argument, it may have a different standard of review even. Either way, I think that we get to the same result, which is that my client was sentenced to prison for this length of time without sufficient guarantees that his had an opportunity to be heard, time and place and manner, as these 8 days between a first appearance, and as the record reflects, his first appearance was with separate counsel, Ms. Cahill, and the second appearance was by Mr. Morrison. Now, the state replies to this argument of mine, indicating that a couple of arguments. Number one, they say, well, the appellant had 4 months to prepare while he was not turning himself in, and that somehow that addresses a public defender's ability to be prepared for a hearing. You know, number one, we're not arguing the ineffective assistance of counsel test the way it's normally argued. We're not saying that the public defender didn't do something he should have done, that his representation fell below a reasonable standard of care, that's a different kind of an argument. And I think that the state's reply to my brief wants to kind of couch this in a different way, because I can't argue that he didn't do it. He stood up and he said, "Judge, I need a continuance. And here's why I need a continuance." And he went through that laundry list to justify a continuance.
So, Mr. Kelly, can I interrupt just for a minute and ask a question? And I know you're kind of late to the game, and you know you weren't there then. And so the question is there anything in the record, kind of a proffer of evidence, in connection with a petition for post-conviction relief, of what it is, of where they're, you know, this may have actually, the denial of a continuance harmed your client's ability, you know, to get the facts out in front of the judge. And I know they're, you know, I'm mindful of, well, you know, trying to prove that his mother actually was hospitalized for cancer treatments and he was needed there. But is there, was any of that evidence put in front of the post-conviction court?
So attached to the petition, no. And if the court were to find that somehow the offer of proof associated with that post-conviction petition was inadequate to grant a hearing, that doesn't change the matrix of my original argument. I was attempting to supplement the record for this court to be able to perhaps address the Austin factors and literally make a finding that, based on everything here, you just can't send a guy to prison who's completed Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge after his last violation, has been on paper for a number of years, and has some missed meetings when his mother's going to the hospital and needs to be transported. So, you know, I tried to get there through that post-conviction petition to develop that record. I was denied the opportunity for that hearing. Although I note the court, in denying my opportunity for that hearing, didn't miss the chance to supplement the record, which was, well, with regard to the Austin factors.
Yeah, so that's what I want to talk to you about. So the court did, you know, a little Austin analysis at the time of the probation revocation hearing and revoking the probation. But then used the post-conviction proceeding as an opportunity to make a really extensive record. Is it appropriate for this court to look at that record in considering your argument that the Austin findings were insufficient in the first instance or not? And if not, why not?
I can't say that it is not part of the record in terms of this court's consideration. I would submit that it's not fair, because we're not, they denied me the opportunity to develop my facts and then used whatever they had to somehow supplement the Austin findings. But the relief that my client needs first and foremost is an opportunity to make that argument to the district court on remand. That's first and foremost. If this court wanted to go the extra mile and say that Austin factors were not met and once again, remand for further proceedings, I think we wind up in the same place procedurally, and that is that my client has to establish amenability to probation. And that's why that TDF case is so on point, is because when you look at the certification of decision by a district court of a juvenile and the probation violation, I think that they both turn on amenability in their current, the appellant's amenability in their current status, whether it's as a juvenile or as a probationer.
Okay, so along those lines, in the post-conviction order, the district court essentially said, okay, you know, maybe he didn't have an opportunity to present the evidence. It wouldn't have mattered to me anyway, because we've got these prior probation violations. I wouldn't have found him credible anyway because he lied to his PO. What are we to make of all of that in, you know, determining whether there was an abuse of discretion and denying the continuance and ultimately whether the revocation itself was appropriate?
I would respectfully submit that the lack of preparation vitiates any of that logic. You can't come into a hearing as a public defender, and these people are doing the Lord's work, right? They're getting underpaid, underappreciated, and they're trying to come in to do a hearing regarding basically the rest of my client's natural life. And he says, Judge, I need a continuance for the good reasons I'm stating. For the district court to say, I'm not even gonna let you present the evidence that you need to present. I've already made up my mind. That's not how the Austin factors work. That's not how the district court should apply the Austin factors. Come back to say, I'm not sure what you would have presented to me, but regardless of what you would have presented to me, that's not fair. When you look at the record, my client tries to, and he does it inartfully, but he's blurting out facts that he needs the court to hear. He doesn't even, when I talk about witness preparation, when I prepare my client to testify before a court, I have to sit down with them, talk to them about the organization of their thoughts, talk to them about how they're going to present this for the listener so that it's digestible. And he is so completely ill-prepared because he couldn't even go see his client in the jail. Now, that was all going to change on Friday the 12th. It was all going to change. He was going to be able to get into the jail to meet with his client. There's just, I can't imagine why the district court would not have granted this continuance request, knowing the lack of prejudice to the state. I would submit that my attempted post-conviction, and this was direct appeal, correct? I mean, this was a direct appeal during the appropriate time frame. This case is on direct appeal. I simply attempted to supplement the record with that post-conviction petition and a request for a hearing, an attempt to supplement the record, and was denied that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Kelly. And next we will hear from Mr. Hajdukovic. You may proceed.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney and I represent the respondent in this matter. The state's asking this court to affirm the revocation of appellant's probation and the execution of his sentence. And I'll start with the continuance issue that counsel spent his argument on. And the first thing I want to address, I guess, is this question of Mr. Kelly saying he was trying to supplement the record in the post-conviction petition. The problem is that there was no offer of proof made in the post-conviction petition. There was no affidavit submitted or not even any facts alleged that weren't already a part of the record. And as a result, there was simply no need for an evidentiary hearing, which are really only required if there are facts alleged in the post-conviction petition, typically supported by an affidavit or some other form of declaration that are, you know, are contradictory, that create essentially a fact question. And here we don't have any of those fact questions that have been raised. So there was no need for an evidentiary hearing. The record was what it was. And to answer the question about, is it proper for the district court in the post-conviction context to answer or to supplement its findings in terms of the Austin factors. As I noted in my brief, the Motland case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I think really this is standard in these cases, when an appellate court remands a case for insufficient findings on the Austin factors, they remand to allow the district court to make further factual findings. So I guess as a practical matter, I don't think there's any difference between remanding from this court and allowing the court to make the records or just the court making the records before the record before the case is remanded to it. There's really not any practical difference there, and that's what the court did here. So I think those findings are properly before the court.
So Mr. Hajdukovic, as to the record that was before the district court at both stages of the proceeding, because there was no evidentiary hearing, you're contending that it was not an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court to to not allow the continuance. But do we really even have a complete record of what would have been presented, given the statements of the public defender that, you know, he had a few avenues that he wanted to look into, and the denial of the continuance?
Well, I think what we have is, I guess all I can say to in response to that is we have what is in the record, and that's all we have. And if the court feels that's incomplete, then I think that answers the question, to be quite honest. But what I would say, however, is that not only does there have to be an abuse of discretion, there also has to be some showing of prejudice. And here there really isn't any showing of prejudice in the denial of the continuance. What we have in the offer of proof that was made at the time of the continuance request is the fact that the appellant was in custody, and at the time the jail restrictions didn't allow for in-person visitation and relatively limited phone contact. And the other major piece, I believe, was that counsel wanted to look into the hospital records about appellant's mother's condition, and also get some statements taken from people who the appellant had been spending time with in the previous, I believe, year is what he said, presumably to try to demonstrate sobriety and amenability and things like that. There really isn't any prejudice here because, first of all, again, Mr. Kelly had the opportunity in the post-conviction petition to try to present some of that evidence as an offer of proof. If he had done that, I think the record would look different, and that was an advantage that was available by going the route that this case has gone through in terms of a state appeal and a post-conviction process. We weren't necessarily stuck with the record as it existed at the time the district court denied the continuance. The record could have been supplemented and wasn't.
Go ahead, Judge Kalatowski.
I'm sorry. Going back to the denial, how are you going to show prejudice when counsel says, I'm not prepared, I haven't talked to my client, I haven't had, and we've got COVID, as counsel for appellant points out. We also have a very short time frame between the time this counsel was appointed. And so you have a counsel coming before a court saying, I'm not prepared to do this hearing. How are we going to determine whether appellant was prejudiced because of his attorney's unpreparedness and admitted unpreparedness?
Well, I think there's two answers to that question. The first is just looking at counsel's performance during the hearing itself, which wanting more information, I certainly understand that counsel wanted more information, but in terms of the information he had, I think counsel did everything he could have done with that information. But then to look at it more broadly, again, what I'd point to is if there was going to be this evidence that counsel could have gathered now that many months have passed since the probation revocation hearing, we still don't have any of that evidence, and it could have been presented through the post-conviction process, and it wasn't.
So are you asking us to essentially hold against this defendant that there was a petition for post-conviction relief filed? I mean, in other words, are you asking us to take this out of the direct appeal context and fault the defendant for the post-conviction petition?
No, not at all. I'm not asking the court to fault anyone. What I'm trying to articulate is essentially if this evidence existed, it certainly could have been found by now, and it hasn't been, apparently. Or I can only presume it would have been presented. That's the point I'm trying to make here, however inartfully. The other thing I would note, however, is that, first of all, and I don't want to move away from the continuance issue, I don't want the court to take it as me trying to do that, but in terms of the district court's actual findings in the post-conviction order and the appellant's brief in this case, their brief only challenges the sufficiency of the evidence on the second prong, whether the violation was intentional or inexcusable. As I noted in my brief, the appellant's brief doesn't even address the fact that the appellant didn't complete a cognitive skills class. And in fact, the appellant in his testimony at the contested hearing admitted that he hadn't completed the class that he was required to complete. And so that's a sufficient basis right there that I don't see how it could have been cured by a continuance in terms of a lack of prejudice on the sufficiency of the evidence issue that's before the court right now. But the,
well, and doesn't the evidence that the public defender wanted to present go to the question of whether the violation was intentional or inexcusable?
I think it goes, at least some of it would go towards parts of that evidence, I would agree, in terms of the hospital visits and that information. But what I'd say in response to that is this, that is, at least as I read the record, there were two instances in which the appellant was alleged to be in violation of his probation in terms of missed drug tests, and where the where he said he was visiting his mother at the hospital or being with her in the hospital while she dealt with her cancer. One was in November of 2019 and one was in October of 2019. If you look at the findings, both on the record that were made in terms of what the violations were, as well as then the subsequent post-conviction order, that October 2019 date was not found to be a violation of probation in the first instance. So that's, there is no prejudice as to that particular incident. As to the November incident, that was found to be a violation of probation. However, it was just one in a series of missed tests where the appellant, missed tests, sometimes would come back the next day and do it, sometimes wouldn't. And then we take that in combination with, again, the cognitive skills course, which the probation officer explained are really designed to get people change how they think in terms of the consequences of their actions and the criminality of their actions and why they think the way they do. So that's obviously an important piece of probation. And there's never been really an excuse, at least a legitimate excuse offered about why the appellant didn't complete that. And in fact, as I said, he admitted to that in his testimony during the probation violation hearing. And so that in itself is enough for that inexcusable behavior violation.
So in looking at the denial of the continuance request, should we be limited to the sort of evidence that the public defender noted he hoped to obtain in determining whether there was prejudice? Should we only focus on those things, or can we consider what we don't know? Do you know what I'm saying? We don't know what would have happened if a continuance had been granted. Is that an appropriate thing for us to consider?
That's a very good question. And my answer to that is I don't believe we should consider the true unknowns. I mean, I'll certainly concede that there's always going to be some element of unknown in terms of evaluating any prejudice issue, because we're really evaluating a counterfactual. But I think we should be limited to what counsel raised in his argument before the court as to the continuance request, because other than that, I think, first of all, that would really then place or make it, I guess, very, very difficult in any case in which a continuance is denied to demonstrate a lack of prejudice if we're going to look at anything that could have come up. And there could always be prejudice in the opposite direction that, and I'm not asserting there would have been here, but that always could happen as well when a continuance is denied. If it had been granted, the other party could be prejudiced and we wouldn't know that either, because again, we're evaluating a counterfactual. So I do think it's important to just stick to the proffered reasons at the time of the hearing, because I think that's the only fair way to evaluate it without getting, I guess, more speculative than what the test would typically call for. In terms of, one other thing I wanted to briefly address was the Miller case in terms of the due process issue that Mr. Kelly cited. The Miller case, as I read it, Miller argued on appeal that his due process rights were violated by the denial of a continuance. But as I read the opinion of the court in that case, the court analyzed it under the typical abuse of discretion and prejudice standard for denial of a continuance. So I don't think it really stands for the proposition that there could be a denial of due process based on the denial of the continuance. And I mean, we have a test obviously in place for the denial of a continuance and whether it prejudices the defendant. So there's certainly relief that can be gained there.
I have one other question. So in considering the continuance question, we look at the reasons that were offered by the defense in support of the continuance. What about the other side of the picture? I mean, why why wouldn't the judge have given a continuance in this case, given that he was in custody and this was COVID? I mean, are we to consider, you know, why a continuance wasn't granted and whether there was a good enough reason there in determining whether there was an abuse of discretion?
I think that's fair game, quite candidly. It only seems fair to look at both sides of the coin. And I know that in other instances, you know, there might be a claim by the state that they could be prejudiced for one reason or another by a continuance. And the court may also have other reasons in terms of their calendar or things like that. And again, that's not the case here, as far as the record indicates. But I think it's fair game to look at the entirety of the situation and present it at the time. My point is that I just don't think it's proper to look at things that may be raised after the fact. I wish from my perspective that the judge had given a more clear statement of why the continuance was being denied. I can only infer from the record that the judge agreed with the position of the probation officer and the prosecutor that there wasn't a need for a continuance and that it wasn't going to change anything and the evidence was what it was. And if the court thinks that that's an abuse of discretion, then we just need to go to the prejudice prong. And that, again, I would just emphasize there that I think that's where the appellant's claim falls much, much more clearly short than it does in the abuse of discretion realm. I think the abuse of discretion issue is quite honestly a closer call than but I don't think the prejudice issue is a particularly close call because there just hasn't been any showing of prejudice that seems particularly feasible in this case. Just to address the question of the fact that there was the pandemic and obviously still is, and that there were all these restrictions in terms of visiting at the jail, what there hasn't really been is any showing or any allegation, frankly, other than what counsel stated during this argument today about why that would have made a difference in this case. I'm not going to pretend that it would be just as easy for counsel to prepare during the pandemic, especially when the restrictions were as tight as they were, than it would be in normal times. That certainly is not the case. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. But again, there's just no showing of prejudice there other than speculation. The hearing got messy because of appellant's interjections. I would agree with that. But again, I think the appellant was able to testify to the information that he wanted to testify about ultimately. It came out and the court found the probation officer's testimony to be credible. For all those reasons, unless there's any further questions, I would just ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hajdukovic. And now back to you, Mr. Kelly. We'll get your 5 minutes up. If you'd like to give rebuttal, you may proceed.
Thank you. As to the issue of what would have changed, and I think this is all in the record, there was some comment about a doctor's appointment being for a Botox injection, which is routinely quite common to be given for cosmetic type of treatment. This, my client's mother and the continuance would have allowed proof that the Botox injection was in fact a medical treatment at Mayo. This was not a cosmetic. But I think that I'm not sure the district court understood that, quite frankly, that the Botox injection appointment was medically related, not cosmetically related. But as to the COG skills.
Mr. Kelly, could you give us your best shot at what the prejudice was here?
The prejudice was that my client would have been able to present witnesses on his behalf from Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge, a program that he had completed since he was last reinstated on probation. And I can tell this court that some of the most powerful sentencing arguments I've ever made to district courts involve the appearance of and the statements by people from Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge that vouch for the character and amenability of the probationer. The COG skills class, Mike, the appellant would have been able to provide certification of completion of COG skills class since his last probation violation. So he would have shown compliance with that prong of the court sentence. Counsel, I think incorrectly, says that he admitted that he didn't attend the COG skills class that was directed by the agent or something along those lines. He was basically trying to own some portion of this violation and show the court, I think, that he was understood that he had done wrong. But the fact is that the record indicates, my client tries to indicate to the court, and I think even the, on cross-examination, there's COG skills as part of Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge. And my client had completed, I think, could have provided perhaps up to 3 certificates of completion of COG skills classes since he was sentenced by the district court many years earlier. So, you know, that issue would have gone to amenability. And that's the answer to the court's question. That's what we would have been able to show. When you're talking about executing a 276 month sentence, it deserves more than this. When the public defender comes in and says, I've been locked out of the jail because of COVID, he doesn't have access to a phone, I've got witnesses that I want to call, I need to prepare. That request for continuance must be granted, or it's just, in my opinion, garbage in, garbage out. There's no way to develop a record to show amenability when you can't prepare for a hearing. And so even if there
can we consider the statements as simply the statements about the public defender's inability to meet with his client as evidence of prejudice?
Whose statements?
The statements made at the hearing by the public defender that he'd not been able to meet with the client, is that evidence of prejudice?
I think that it's per se prejudice when you don't get to meet with your client. I think that it's per se, at least you're at a distinct disadvantage. And once again, what would have been different? It's hard to develop that, isn't it? Based on the denial of the petition for post-conviction relief to develop the record on direct appeal. I think that the prejudice is in the record. That, for example, the certification of the completion of the COG skills program. My client could have provided the court with a certificate of completion and testimony that he completed a COG skills program. It seems the counsel indicated that that was one of the linchpins for him doing 276. When in fact, if he had completed that class and he said, I have completed a COG skills class, that was part of the programming at Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge. Well, I would, in closing, I would just suggest that the collective we, as practitioners, district court judges, at this court of appellate review, this just can't stand. We have to be better than this. And I ask the court to remand to the district court with that message. We need to have a full hearing with opportunity and evidence before we make such a grave decision. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. And I'll just note the case was very well briefed as well as argued. And it is now submitted to us. We will be issuing our decision within the statutory timeframe. Take care.